Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. You know, The Rock's in the new G.I. Joe.
Really? Cool. I heard Bruce Willis is, too.
Yeah, I just thought...
Yep. So how drunk are you going to get for this one?
It has to be pretty drunk.
Lyle's advice for watching the previous one was, get drunk. The ice sinks. Get drunk.
How many beers was the first G.I. Joe movie? Like, six?
I didn't drink enough. That was the problem.
You take a shot every time they say Joe.
Yeah. But that reminds me, because G.I. Joe's got Channing Tatum, and I watched a good movie of his called 21 Jump Street.
Would you care to elaborate?
I think people know what that movie is.
All right, fine.
21 Jump Street, based on the 80s TV show 21 Jump Street. It's a comedy.
I lost.
Co-stars Jonah Hill. Yeah, it's actually really good.
As opposed to G.I. Joe.
Which is really bad.
Yeah. I watched that Stone Cold Sober, and it was good. Yeah, so I would recommend that if you haven't seen it, or like kind of hold. I mean, because I was like, well, I don't really need to see a remake of that TV show. Mm-hmm. And people are like, well, you know, the reviews were like, oh, surprisingly good. So I was like, okay,
yeah,
it's definitely worth it.
Hmm. All right, I'll have to watch it then on your recommendation.
It might be partner friendly as well.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, so
I'll invite my partner over then.
All right. Okay. Would your partner that's living with you mind? Or
I don't know. We'll find out.
I think you might have a better story than watching 21 Jump Street. Yeah. You guys got nothing?
I made my bed tonight.
Oh, jeez.
No, it's actually pretty hard because it's a Japanese bed, so it isn't designed for a person of my girth. So the frame broke underneath it, so I had to rebuild the frame. So I literally made my bed tonight.
Oh, all right.
Well, Japanese bed is really like a futon that's on the floor.
Yes, I know. I broke through the second floor. So. Now, we have a bed from Nitori, but it's a lousy excuse for it. Either that or I'm just too heavy.
I like the image better of you waking up on the floor below you. Like,
whoa. Apartment downstairs. konnichiwa.
You know, I've become a bigger fan of PDFs of late. For games.
What sparked this?
The Marvel Heroic Roleplaying. In that it was very easy to print off the data files, and this is actually related to what we're going to talk about later, for the game.
Right.
Much easier than, you know, going to, like, scanning, like, flattening your book on a scanner or going to the photocopier.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I remember, like, you know, in the old days before PDFs, where the last couple pages were always, you know, character sheets or whatnot, and, yeah, it was a real pain in the ass to photocopy them, or they always had, like, some of them had, like, a dotted line, and they're like, you can cut this page out to photocopy, and I was, you know, one of those people, I'm like, no, I'm not going to cut a page out of a book.
Right, and they had a little line at the bottom, you have permission to photocopy this page.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Right.
So I was going to do it anyway.
What about the other pages?
Yeah.
Well, I was kind of like a person who gets a PDF, and then if you really, really like it, you upgrade to the book.
Right.
And now I'm going to go both ways. Hey-o. And,
I was trying to think of a partner joke. Damn it.
What was that?
Lyle thought that was so hilariously funny. He fell out of his chair.
He threw a cat. Did you fall out of his chair?
All right. No. I just something fell. Oh. Something else fell.
And again, yeah.
I didn't even tell a joke this time.
Well, I got some cleaning up to do after the podcast. you know, the funny thing is, the first thing that fell, not the second, the first thing that fell was Marvel Heroic Roleplaying.
Hmm.
Yeah, good thing I have another copy.
All no, the PDFs fell out.
Yeah, can I finish? So now I'm at where if I buy a book, I'll actually like scale down, if you will, to get the PDF, just so I can get printable character sheets and maps and data files.
Yeah, I think I'm still kind of the opposite, where I'll start with the PDF, and then if I like it, I'll, you know, upgrade to the book. just because, I don't know, it is still nice to have a physical book of some things.
Well, I've got an iPad, so PDFs are awesome for me.
Yeah, if PDFs have, like, touchable spots, you know, where you can just, like, jump to sections or, you know, like, clickable chapters, that's great, instead of having to, like, flip through them. And, yeah, most designers or most people putting out PDFs are doing that, so that's really helpful. But,
If I had a tablet, I'd look at PDFs more, definitely.
Yeah, that's specifically why I want to get one.
Oh, hey, and we also got a really nice email from Ross from the Role Playing Public Radio podcast. Thank you, Ross. He writes in saying that he enjoys the cast and that he was really interested in the Tokyo episodes because he's running a Knights Black Agents game set in Tokyo. And they're going to do the next session in Kabukicho based off of our podcast. So, woohoo! Thank you very much. He had a few questions about Tokyo, though. So, the first one here was, the antagonists of my campaign are a conspiracy of vampires who deal in a mysterious drug. The drug is distributed by a Bosozoku gang that sells it to dealers who work in nightclubs. The gang picks it up from designated drop sites, so they don't know where the drug is made. What would be a good neutral drop site for the conspiracy to use in Tokyo? Each site is only used once, so it has to be anonymous and easily arranged yet secure. They have plenty of cash. And Bosozoku is kind of a motorcycle gang. If you've ever seen the anime Akira, that's what Kaneda and his friends are. It's like a junior Yakuza, as one Bosozoku member explained it to me. They make a lot of noise on motorcycles, but they also deal a lot of drugs and, you know, rough people up and get in fights and things like that.
But generally make noise. That's about all they do.
Yeah. I think they're actually more heavily into the drug trade than the Yakuza are. As far as the distribution, they're kind of another arm of the Yakuza. The Yakuza imports the drugs and the Bosozoku distribute it out. Hmm. Or so I've been told.
Yeah, I was thinking about the video, the Conway West video for Stronger. He actually hired actual Bosozoku in that video. So when you see the guys on the motorcycles driving around, that's the real thing.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Very annoying.
Oh, yeah.
They drive by 3 a.m. gunning their motorcycles.
Yeah, for residents of Japan, actually, all they are is the guys that drive around going ba 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 ba. Yeah. Kind of demystifies them a bit.
Yeah, because they're not even riding like freaking Harleys or anything. They're on like little mopeds and scooters that are like, wah, 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 and you're just like, ah.
Yeah, you just feel like going out with a baseball bat and
you really
just, like,
do.
Knocking them down.
I've had neighbors who have thrown slippers at them from outside the window and stuff, and they just ride off. You know?
Mm. Yeah.
And then they
let's build them up for the game,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, exactly. We're kind of taking the, you know, bringing them down a little bit.
Yeah. In a game, I don't think I'd recommend using a slipper. You know, maybe give the players a penalty if they use that. But the actual question itself, I think it's a really good question, and it applies more than just Kabukicho, just to Japan in general. And, he poses a couple challenges here. One is like a neutral drop site. Hmm. And this is for drugs and money, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And anonymous and easily arranged yet secure. So a few challenges there. They have plenty of cash, but I don't think some of the ideas I had didn't really factor in, you know, the cash part. Or I mean, somebody with not a lot of cash could do these. So, so for you low-level drug dealers, please take notes. Yeah. So I'll preface these ideas with the idea that there, you know, some creative license is being taken here. So, you know, maybe they don't always work in the real world. But the first thing I was thinking of was love hotels.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Kind of think of a hotel equivalent of a no-tell motel.
Right.
And these places are all over the city, but they tend to cluster together. The rooms can be rented for a rest, maybe about 2 hours, or for a stay, which is overnight. And you choose the room, usually from a panel on the wall, if there are different types of room, and you pay anonymously.
Yeah, it's almost like a giant vending machine lobby.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah. That's a good description, yeah. Like where there's a barrier that kind of covers the face, mm-hmm. so you can't see the person you're paying and they can't see your face. Mm-hmm. And you're not given the key to the room. Instead, you just go up to wherever the room is and it's open. The problem is, of course, if you go out and it locks behind you, then you can't get back in.
Yep.
So one idea would be is one group would go in for a rest and drop off the package, leave. Then the next group goes into the same room for another rest to pick it up. And one thing, though, is that the group would need the hotel staff to be in on it to ensure that the room doesn't get cleaned afterwards or get necessarily rented out to another right. person. Now, because it's anonymous, I think you would have to have something like, let's say the room costs for a rest 6,000 yen. Somebody who pays 60,000 yen or 16,000 yen for that 6,000 yen room is sending the signal that they're in on it, you know?
Do not disturb.
Yeah. So they would wait for the next person to come in and get that same room and pay that same amount. So that covers both the bribe, but also the signal.
You bring up love hotels. Like, another thing I thought of doing after you said that was just rent it for a stay. You know, have some kind of courier or whatever just stay there, and then people could come up and get it. And, yeah, you would have to find someone to stay there for, like, however long between the drop-off and getting it again. But it would only be, like, one payment, and then you would make sure that, you know, no one else used the room, anything like that.
One thing about the love hotels is they have, you can order food while you're in there. And the way that they deliver the food is they have kind of like a window next to the door. And the staff will just come up and they'll kind of slide it into this window. So again, it's complete anonymity. Nobody can see you. But if you had one of the staff in on it to where they, instead of putting food inside the tray, they put in whatever the drug is, then they could just slide it right in. You'd never see who it is on the other side. So you just go in, pay for the room, order something special off the menu. And, yeah, it comes right to the room. You never see who delivers, and you leave with it.
Yeah, it'd be pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, the code is what they order.
Yeah, when I was looking at this, my first thought is, and admittedly it's not that exciting, is just train station lockers. Much like airport lockers I'm sure you've seen in movies before, nearly every train station in Japan comes with rows of lockers, and Tokyo is filled with train stations all over the place, so it'd be really easy. But it's not as much drama as there might be in a kind of a love hotel situation.
No, I thought, you know, train lockers as well, too, but then it gets tricky about how do you get the key to the person, you know?
No, they have new lockers now in Tokyo, in the Shinjuku area, where you actually get a code. So
that's
you can,
cool.
Yep, you can email the code. So what they do when you actually do it is they give you a little slip of paper, and the little slip of paper has the code on it.
Right.
And then you go back to the coin locker when you want to pick up your stuff, and you punch in the code, and then boom, the locker opens.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yep, so that the coin locker one could work now.
Yeah, do that.
Yeah, I figured you could always pay off somebody at like one of the soap places, one of the fuzoku, which is, it's kind of like soft core prostitution that they do a lot of in Japan, where it's you go in and a naked girl will come in and wash you, and there might be a blowjob or something involved like that. I haven't tried it myself to say.
Is that soft? Sorry, what?
Yeah, but I mean, if you had one of those people paid off, it's those places are illegal, so it's in their best interest to keep everything on the down low and anonymous. So.
Sorry, I didn't realize like blowjobs were soft prostitution.
Yeah, I suppose it's not.
That kind of seemed like full on, and they call those soap lands, as opposed to soap places.
I'll take your word for it.
Oh, whatever. Oh. He's playing coy now.
Now the other one that I heard of, and a student told me this once that I was teaching, and he said he was up in a bar, and I think he was up in Tokyo. But it was a bar that had been used for comfort ladies and imported Koreans who had been basically sex slaves. And the bartender showed him that the bar itself was hollow and had a little door by where the staff go behind the bar. And that area used to be, the women would crawl in there if the police ever showed up for it. So you could use that as a place to stash and hide drugs and things if the bar owner. But I suppose that's not really mobile, but maybe just an idea of some of the options that have existed in Japan for different places.
Here's another idea that I had. Bottle keeps. I don't know if these are in other countries. It's just something that I was introduced to in Japan. So I'll just explain it in case people are unaware of it. It's like in certain bars, they'll let you keep a bottle.
Right.
And then when you go back, and they'll write your name on it, and nobody else can drink from that bottle. Sorry, a bottle of like hard liquor or something like that, not like a bottle of beer.
Give me my Coke.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'll be finishing this next week. Oh, it's flat. And what you do is the next time you go in, then you rent a glass, or sometimes they might present it as you're buying the ice.
Yeah,
but you pay, let's say, 500 yen or $5 for this glass, and then you can drink as much as you want, as opposed to paying like what you would for whiskey or shochu. Or so it is. It works out to be cheaper, but it's kind of like a regular thing. So what I was thinking is that somebody could get a bottle, but they, instead of with hard liquor, it's actually filled up with the drugs.
Mm.
And of course, again, the bar staff has to be in on it, because I think they'll notice when, you know, it's not a clear amber liquid, but, you know, cocaine.
Yeah, like, wow, yeah, bottle full of bags. Okay. That's a bit odd.
All right.
So you need a glass? No, I'll be fine. Thanks.
I'll just take ice with that? Yeah, sure. I don't know. It's like, does this really make sense in the real world? No. But it's kind of cinematic and a little, you know. So I think that could be kind of fun, and you go to the bottle keep, you say the name, and, you know, wink, wink, you pay for the glass, and then he gives you the bottle, and you pour out that bottle into your briefcase or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, don't apply physics to this and thinking, like, how do you pour
it's
out,
a game
like,
of vampires, so.
20 baggies out of a little bottle? You're like, well, you don't.
I think of all the ideas, though, actually, the first one you said there, Lyle, the Love Hotels, is probably the best, too, because you can have so much fun with that in games, because you just look up Love Hotels on the internet. They come in all kinds of different crazy themes, so you can really flesh out the settings and have a lot of fun with what you're doing in a session inside these Love Hotels. But I say use that one if you like it.
Well, another idea might be the, you know, how there's, like, these little tiny shrines throughout the cities. And honestly, I wouldn't say that there's a tremendous respect for these shrines.
What, stashing drugs at it isn't respectful? Oh, jeez.
Yeah, no, but like as far as the secure thing, you can just kind of play it up. Is that, you know, in Japan, it doesn't matter who you are. There's so much respect for, you know, Buddhism or Shinto that no one will dare violate it. So you could stash money or drugs and it'll be safe and secure. Mm-hmm. Again, some creative license is taken there, but it can help you play up the Japanese aspect. Mm-hmm. And these shrines can be very, very tiny. Like, we're talking, I don't know, like
closet-sized?
Yeah, like a closet. That's a good example. I mean, some of them can be full-on and smack in the middle of, like, the busiest area of Tokyo. So you could, if you wanted to have somebody go into actually, like, kind of a shrine and have that, you know, walking into the past aspect. Or it could be, like, yeah, just, like, this closet in the shape of a shrine with just, like, there was one near this business hotel I stayed in, and there was just, like, a little chain around it, like, almost, like, you know, courtesy chain, an honor system.
Right.
You know, stay away from the shrine during off hours.
Yeah.
So easily you could do something with that as well, and you put it into... I mean, there's a grate where people chuck money into it to make a wish.
Yeah, yeah.
So you could lift the grate, put your stuff in there, put the grate back down. You could put it, you know, tape it to the bell that they have. You know, people kind of ring that and clap their hands, and that's how they pray.
Yeah. They almost all have some kind of statue, be it a fox or one of the tanuki raccoon dogs or some dragon or something like that. So you can stash it, like, in the mouth of the dragon.
Yeah, yeah. Or you could put it on the roof, you know, because they have those very pronounced eaves. So, there's a lot you can do with that as well. And again, would it really work for, you know, aspiring drug dealers coming to Japan? No. I don't recommend that. But I think for a game, I mean, the flavor is there.
Yeah.
So. I really like the idea of one of those hidden shrines, because, like, it's not only Tokyo that does that. Like, even here in Osaka, like, you can live in an area, as I did for, like, years, and then, you know, walk down a side street and, like, oh, hey, I didn't realize there was, like, a shrine in the middle of this block, you know?
Cleaning behind the bookshelves and, holy crap!
Well, not that, but, you know, like, you walk down the street, you go into what would be, like, the interior of a block, you know, kind of, instead of going around, like, the outside of it, and you're like, oh, wow, there's this tiny little shrine right in here.
And you're not wrong, though. Yeah. It's crazy, because you'll have these new modern buildings and stuff, you'll have a monorail right next to it and stuff, but here's these moss-covered stones just right in the middle of it all.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of bizarre.
And the next question was, the vampires control the Red Emperors, which is actually the Bozozoku gang, and the Society of Purity and Justice, which is an ultra-nationalist faction. What are the typical hangouts and habits of both of these groups? The players are secret agent types, so they'll be investigating them, and anything I can give them about their usual habits would be good. Hell, any gameable material will be good.
They're both very loud.
Very,
very loud.
Yeah.
The ultra-nationalist party, they, instead of driving around at night doing their motorcycle stuff, they'll drive around in the daytime in these large black vans with all the windows tinted pure black, with these humongous loudspeakers on them, just yelling out nationalist rhetoric all day long.
Oh, actually, I saw an ultra-nationalist bus on the weekend. in Shinjuku.
Was it like a tour bus with the top part open so people could stand on top of it and shout?
No, I've seen those before, you know, where they're kind of one of those scaled-down buses. Mm. This was a full-on inner-city bus length, but it was one of those buses. No, sorry, it was one of those ultra-nationalist vehicles. And we should explain, it's like they do literally paint everything black.
Right.
Except for white, big, bold white kanji, or Chinese characters on the sides, and perhaps the back. And then they have loudspeakers attached to them, blaring, usually kind of like nationalistic songs, anthems. Mm-hmm. But then they'll use those loudspeakers when they do like little rallies and, you know, go on. Generally anti-Chinese, anti-American, and anti-Korean.
Stuff. It is seriously loud. There's no noise pollution laws in Japan, as you can probably tell from these descriptions. But when I was working at a school before, we were up on the sixth floor of the building. And when these things were driving, even when they were a block away or so, we literally couldn't hold class because the sound was so loud. It was amazingly noisy.
Yeah, well, they also don't just kind of drive around. They'll eventually, like...
They'll park somewhere.
Yeah, they'll park somewhere and have a little, like, impromptu... Not really a rally. It's more like a tirade, you know, where, you know, people just kind of stand around with flags and yell through loudspeakers or megaphones that are going back to the PA system on the van.
Yep.
And like neo-Nazis, not a lot of women in these groups.
Whoa, big surprise there.
Yeah. Typical hangouts. Again, thinking the Shinjuku area, but probably just in general.
Yeah. Bosozoku, just think kids. Kids with motorcycles and money, because they're dealing drugs and stuff. I mean, they'll hang out in parking lots in front of stores. There's this chain of stores called Don Quixote, which sells really cheap junk, just like toys and cheap jewelry and makeup and motorcycle parts and stuff, and
right.
They always used to hang out in front of there when I lived nearby one, in bars and things like that. Just, you know, just imagine kids running around with motorcycles and money, where they would hang out. That's where you'd find your bosozoku.
Yeah, convenience store parking lots, shopping mall parking lots, you know, pretty much anywhere they can put their bikes at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, for the ultra-nationals, I don't know that much about them. One of my friends used to be married to a woman whose father was in the ultra-nationalist party, but he was also pretty heavily tied up with the Yakuza, so they hung around like rich people do, you know. They hung out in nice restaurants and nice bars and things like that. They think Godfather kind of thing, you know. But I don't know if that holds true for all nationalist people or just for the ones that are heavily in with the Yakuza or not, and I don't even know if that's a regular thing or not.
So, yeah, I'd really play that up, the organized crime connections. And that means that they would be, like, controlling gambling sites. And that would be... Pachinko seems kind of normal, mainstream. So the Mahjong gambling sites.
Right.
Or the hostess bars or the show pubs.
Yeah.
Or the, as Chris mentioned before, the soap lands. I think those would be...
Yeah, probably.
Pretty good. Other hangouts, and this is just something if people have heard about the karaoke boxes that's in Japan, but I would see, like, especially the ultra-nationalist faction, they're a bit more old-fashioned, so they would probably frequent karaoke bars where you sing in front of a bunch of people, kind of, which would be very similar to back home. Or they might frequent things called... mama-san bars, where there's generally an older woman who kind of sits behind the bar and it's her place, and she talks and entertains kind of lonely older men, you know, things like that. I think those would be good.
Yeah.
We talked about what a hostess club was in the Tokyo episode and in a previous episode. So, but it's pretty much just women who are there to talk to men and pour their drinks and light their cigarettes.
Yeah, I get a feeling that for the nationalist, for the ultra-nationals, I think the higher-ups are probably into the organized crime thing, like, again, tied with the Yakuza, but I think the lower-down guys, kind of the rank and file, I get an impression that they're just kind of regular guys. They have a 9-to-5 job, and on the weekends they put on their black fatigues and jump in the van and start, you know, singing nationalist songs. So I think, you know, you could probably look at them as a lot of mundane, perhaps even portray them as maybe kind of sad characters. You know, they don't have much to live for except this rah-rah rally on the weekends.
Yeah, no, I mean, it could be that. I mean, we have vampires controlling these guys, so you could actually play up you know, the sad factor, and that could work for the story. And something like along what Chris is saying is, I mean, firearms are really strictly regulated.
Yeah.
And restricted. So some people, though, and somebody near where Chris lived before, he would drive around in like a souped up Jeep with a fake machine gun in the back.
Yeah, big old 50 caliber.
And there was a cosplay festival in Osaka the other weekend, and people showed up in like full on military gear, and we're talking not like just regular soldier, but like special forces gear.
Yeah, I think it was like a ghillie suit, like actual full on camouflage stuff. Where if the guy laid down in the field, you would not see him. Of course, yep. He was out in the middle of a city, you know, on the asphalt, and you're like, yeah, I can see you perfectly.
What's that bush doing?
You
know,
gray would have been better than the green, but yeah, and then replica guns. I mean, but they're not the real guns, but they're the replica guns. But
what? Yeah, like something.
But people, yeah, like you could do two ways. You could make it where they don't get the replica guns. They're pretty much survivalists and neo-Nazis like you would get back home. Mm. Or you can play up the sad factor, which makes them, I guess, easier to manipulate by the vampires. And yeah, they've got this gun cabinet of fake guns.
Yeah. If you're familiar with airsoft guns, they look like the real thing, but they just shoot little plastic BBs.
Right. And, you know, just kind of like in that fantasy world, and they'll dress up in these ultra nationalists thinking about a Japan that never was. Mm-hmm. And doing that. And both of those could be, depending on the tone of the game, both of those can be really interesting angles to take. But yeah, just where they would hang out is like, are they very involved in organized crime? And then you're looking at gambling and the sex trade. Are they just kind of people disappointed in their life? And then you're looking at nostalgia.
And yeah, apartments.
They're going to cosplay festivals. They are going to karaoke bars so they can sing songs from the 60s and 70s. And some music that you might want to be interested in is called Enka. And that's more of a very, I'll say, a traditional pop music. So it's not like if you get like that CD Sounds from Kyoto and it's the shamisen and bang, dong, dong, dong. You know, that would be like what the geisha played in the 17th century or 18th century. But Enka is kind of like a pretty distinct Japanese-style pop music that came out maybe in the 50s, 60s. It's kind of Japan's doo-wop. Or I don't know.
I can see that.
I just made that up.
Just so you know, though, it's not very catchy. It's not very upbeat. It's pretty slow and low.
Yeah, and absolutely. No, it's... Japan's
and emotional.
Country music.
Oh, Japan's country music. There you go.
Yeah, that's
because it's like, you know, my girlfriend left me and my car don't run. But it's in Japanese.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. And actually, like, it really does affect the older generation. Almost every time I've been out to karaoke, so a bunch of old guys will start singing and they'll get emotional. More than once, tears have come out singing Enka.
Well, they're also probably getting drunk, too. So.
But no, of course.
That's a factor.
That's the point.
I would have mentioned alcohol all plays a factor in this.
Yeah. Now, yeah, I was going to say, you mentioning the guys with the fake guns, I reminds me of like another place is like, they're not exactly military surplus stores because, yeah, they can't, you know, sell real guns. But I've run across a couple stores that are, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know. I guess kind of like a military resale store.
They're military surplus stores. I think a military surplus store that sells guns has to get a special license even in America.
Fair enough. Yeah, now I was thinking there was some change from back in the States, I couldn't remember the name of it, but...
Anyway. Yeah, maybe, but some of the... I'm from Canada, so the military surplus store in Canada is very similar to the one that you get fine in Japan. Hmm. Because, yeah, like, boots aren't illegal.
Yeah. No, but I could see, like, a group of sad guys hanging out in the store, or, you know, in the back there, not really doing anything, but just kind of, yeah, sitting there, buying stuff, you know. Looking at the uniforms and, yeah, then going home to a gun rack full of plastic guns and replicas, yeah.
Well, you know, actually, with that in my way, because, Lyle, you recommended that as one possibility that they kind of are like the neo-Nazis in the States, you know, where they hold themselves up kind of in a cabin out in the woods and play survivalist games and things. That's still very possible in Japan. I mean, even though a lot of the media portrays Japan as like one gigantic Blade Runner-esque city, the country-to-city ratio is actually almost the same as Switzerland. It's just all of the cities are bunched up against the coast. But if you drive for an hour or two outside of the cities, you can hit these miles and miles and miles of empty woodlands and mountains and areas. So it's very easy to have a group that would be out in the woods playing pseudo-military games, though they would almost definitely not have guns, again, if it were realistic. So that's also a third option there, too.
That's a really good point to make, because I think a lot of people forget about it and forget about that. And, you know, it's funny, like, even very close to the cities are virtually abandoned towns. Because it's very much shifted to an urban society, and it's shifting more and more. And like there's a person that Wayne and I work with, and his in-laws live in a city that's maybe it was a city once, now it's a ghost town. And it's just closing and closing. It's just like only old people live there. It's a real problem in Japan, and that it's very tough for them to keep young people or to get young people to move out to these areas. But what it does, and I was like, I thought that was so exciting in a sense, in that, you know, oh, you could film movies there, you know, take advantage of that. But then if you imagine in, just in this context, is that the Society of Purity and Justice, you know, they own these towns, you know. So it's just like in America where you have those, the movies, I don't know, you know, how real this is, but, you know, the car breaks down and you're in the city in the, you know, Arizona or...
We don't take too kind to strangers out here. Texas. My Arizona accent.
Yeah, what was that?
You know, and it's just like, you know, it's run by like one guy. And you can actually do that in Japan, and it's slightly sadder, and the town is older. Or it's not. It was like, it's all built up at once in the 60s, and it's just like kind of decayed. But it's like a time capsule.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like back home, but sadder. That would be what we recommend. So, no, but these were some excellent questions, and I think we only, like, scratched the surface. But
yeah,
we intended to, like, just dash off an email to Ross, but then we just started writing it, and we're like, wow, there's a lot we can do with this. So it sounds like a really good game. Hope you guys have some fun with this.
Yeah, and totally, Ross, if you have any other specific questions, feel free to mail us again. We'll definitely... talk more about it.
Yeah, like, have fun with your game out in the sad ultranationalist town controlled by one guy that's full of decayed buildings and old people with fake guns.
Ross,
yeah,
Ross is screaming right now at the computer. I say Kabukicho, Kabukicho, fun land.
Why are you taking me to the mountains?
Yeah, but yeah, I'm like in that area like at least 2 weekends a month right at the moment. So some crazy times. You know, there's a Korean town in Shinjuku.
I'm sure they appreciate the ultranationalists driving by.
Yeah, yeah. You can get good Korean food, you know. Work that into your game. Here's something about Korean food. I don't know if people are familiar with it, but one thing that is kind of hard to get used to is that you reek after you leave the restaurant. I left this Korean restaurant in Shinjuku the other week, and they actually had, like, Febreze.
Oh, wow.
They sprayed the... first you're like, what the hell are you doing? And then you're like, you know, that makes a lot of sense.
Hey, Febreze me again.
Yeah, Febreze me.
Yeah, I suppose garlic and meat cooking on open flame in front of you and all around you, yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, I was going to say, doesn't that kind of go for any bar here in Japan? Because, I mean, like, there's no anti-smoking law, so you reek when you come out of any place just about.
Yeah, but like a Korean restaurant has that special reekiness. Like, you just, wear cotton when you go. Just stuff you could throw in the washing machine. Anyway. All right, well, for the second half of our episode, we're going to do a review of Marvel Heroic Role-Playing, specifically Civil War, which was, I suppose they call them event books?
Yes, I think that's what they call them, yeah, event books.
So what an event book is they take one of those comic book events, you know, that they do generally in the summers, and they, Margaret Weiss Games will release both the Essentials, which is only the information that pertains to that event, and they'll release a premium, which will include also the core rules. So the first one they released was Civil War. Now, we actually wanted to run the vault event or scenario that was in the core rulebook for Marvel Heroic Role-Playing again, because we felt that we didn't get enough out of that adventure, and we wanted to do more, and we wanted to advance a little bit more in the story. And actually redo what we had done before because we had made some mistakes. But we decided to do Civil War next because what we wanted to do is compare that event book with the adventure that was in the core book and see if that was, you know, if there was any difference in level, if you will, even though the game doesn't necessarily have levels, but if Civil War was a more advanced adventure than the core book, and you know, if we would recommend people start with the Vault, or if they could just jump right into Civil War and buy the premium and just go with that.
I think if people were starting, maybe I would suggest just getting the basic operations manual and running what was it, the Vault scenario that's in there. And I'm yep. saying this because, like, I don't know that much about the Marvel Universe, and even though I read the first couple issues of Civil War, which Lyle lent me, I still kind of, I don't know, I feel like there's a lot of backstory you have to know to play in, like, the Civil War event, which, I don't know, it was kind of hard to wrap my head around or get into the, you know, what was going on in the setting, so... It's not like a rules complexity, it was more of a background and setting complexity, and the scenario that's in the operations manual seemed, or the basic edition, seemed a lot more straightforward and easier to jump into.
Yeah, well, this was, I was going to say this about the game in general, but since you bring it up now, Wayne, I think when you play the Marvel Superheroes game, you really should decide at the beginning if you're going to go with it's in the Marvel Universe where all the characters are who they are and they all have their real histories and everything like that, or decide to not. Because if you, a mix doesn't really work, especially if you have people like me and Wayne who know vastly less than we should to actually go with the history of a module like Civil War. So that's just kind of a basic recommendation for the game. Though I totally agree with your point, Wayne. I think this Vault is a little bit friendlier to maybe someone who has less of a familiarity with the Marvel Universe, just because it's smaller in scope. It's not involving all of the different superheroes all over the world fighting against each other. It's a few.
Right.
No, I'm going to have to agree with that in a couple reasons. One is that the actual regular rule book, if you buy the book, it's like, I don't know, like $15 or less. So it's a very nice price to pick up. And the actual adventure, the Vault, is pretty straightforward. And there are not a lot of options. There's a couple of options depending on which, like, superhero you choose. But it's pretty much the same adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when we get to Civil War, it was a big event. You know, the Vault was one thing contained in the Secret Avengers. Like, it was a 6-issue story arc, and it was just for that one book, you know, Secret Avengers. Civil War was a massive crossover event, more superheroes that you could play, and it just was like, there's a lot of different entry points.
Hmm.
And it's a much deeper story. And I had read Civil War, you know, I've run some different games in the past, so I have some game mastering experience, and it was like, wow, you know, there is a lot I could do with it. And you really have to take a step back and say, what do I want to do with it? You know, what's the one story? And unfortunately, we only had one day marked off for this adventure. So I was trying to do like kind of a one shot.
Mm.
It was to get a feel for Civil War and also to get more experience with Marvel heroic role playing. So yeah, it was almost too much stuff for that one shot. No, I mean, not almost. It was definitely too much stuff for that one shot, because there is so much more you can do, and it is so rich. Whereas the Vault, you can actually kind of do the first part of the Vault, even if you don't finish, and you kind of feel like you've got the adventure.
Mm-hmm. Though that said, you know, if you have a group that where everyone is into comics and they know the people and the characters involved for it, man, they would just salivate over this book. I mean, to be able to play all of these people in this game.
I'd still start with the Vault.
Yeah.
Just because the adventure is straightforward, so that means you can concentrate on the rules.
Right.
Good call, yeah.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that in the episode. Just Marvel Heroic role-playing can be both very, very easy to pick up, and it's also like, well, it's a classic, easy to learn, difficult to master game.
Yeah. I was wondering, so you ran both games, Lyle, and I'm wondering, yeah, I kind of leafed through the Civil War book, just the beginning. And I'm wondering, do you think it would have been easier to run if they had set it up as almost like a two-part book, where one section was, okay, this is kind of how to run the game if the players are going to be pro-registration, and this is how to run the game if the players are going to be anti-registration? Because it didn't... I don't think they did that. I don't think that's how the book was organized. It was kind of like, here's what's happening, here's what's going on, here's the events, blah, blah, blah. And as you said, it was kind of too much. Do you think it would have helped if they had broken the book into kind of two sections?
I don't know. I see what you mean. And it would certainly help if you knew what the players wanted to do at the beginning. Because they kind of present options, just like, if the players are pro, do this. If the players are anti, do that. So they certainly do provide you with tips. But yeah, that was certainly a really, really tough thing. And we talk about this. Let's back up a bit and just give some people some background to the Civil War in case they haven't read the comic, even though it was a pretty big event. It's a civil war within the Marvel Universe, in that there's a kind of like a superhero registration act where superpowers have to register their identity. And some heroes, like Mr. Fantastic and Iron Man and Spider-Man, are for it. And some heroes, like Captain America, Hercules, the Punisher, surprise, are against it. And there's a rift, and supervillains kind of fall on either side, but it's primarily heroes versus heroes. And you can tell like an entirely different story depending on whether you're on one side or the other. So it's not like a typical adventure in that you are the good guys and there are bad guys.
Right.
It's which good guys are you?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that poses the extra challenge. So I don't know if that would have helped so much, Wayne, what you're suggesting in that dividing the book in that respect. Because one thing in the book, it does provide a lot of opportunities for players to jump to the other side. Because things can happen. And you see that if people have read the story. I don't want to reveal or provide any spoilers. But we can see in at least one example where somebody is on one side and jumps to the other side because something happens and a scene concludes and they're like, I don't want to be part of this anymore.
Right.
So I think it had to be laid out the way that they did it so that they can give the players an opportunity to jump to the other side.
No, it's a very good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, what I did was like a cardinal sin of a game master and guessed that the players would be a certain side.
And we weren't.
And you weren't. And it's not like completely unprepared for the other side, but you were certainly like, oh, they're definitely going to do this. So I'm definitely going to do this scene. And I thought the guys, Chris and Wayne, were going to be anti-registration, and they decided to be pro to start the game. Blew my mind. And I was like, all right, okay. Now, what we did is we did something a little bit different from the actual book because Wayne wanted to play Doctor Strange because he had some good ideas on what he wanted to do with that. And then Chris just said, I want somebody that could work well with Doctor Strange, and Namor was in the book, and Namor has a background with as being both defenders. I'm a massive fan of the defenders, and also with the new retconned history, they're part of this Illuminati together. So we decided to be Namor. If you look at the book, Namor is an unlockable character, so you can't necessarily play him straight away. And that's something that's part of Marvel Heroic Roleplaying, is that when you get enough experience, you can spend that to unlock characters when it comes to the next act. So we kind of started a little bit in media res, like kind of like in the middle of things, because you're playing like two major powers in Namor and Doctor Strange. And I kind of did it in the kind of a traditional Defender style where you're just kind of hanging out. And that's just kind of how Defenders books tended to start. They're just kind of hanging out together. And then, you know, kind of the Civil War happens. And then as it happens, like people that are part of the Illuminati are like two significant ones, Iron Man and Mr. Fantastic, they are pro-registration. So I used them to approach you guys about pro-registration. And I guess I was too persuasive in my arguments. And like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let's be pro. And I'm like, all right. So for a lot of that, there was no mechanics involved. We just kind of just played.
Yeah.
And unlike the vault, which is in the core book, you just kind of get stuck in, you know, power goes out. Now you're fighting all these inmates. Whereas in the Civil War, there are discussions. And that's where, you know, kind of you can swap and change your allegiance because there's a lot of opportunity to talk about what you really think. Mm-hmm. So there was like a huge chunk of the adventure where you guys just talked to each other.
Yeah.
About what you thought about this registration act. And I just kind of sat there.
And I bet you're like, okay, man, I'm glad I scheduled this so I can have Chris and Wayne just talk to each other.
But my voice is given out guys. At that point. So, I mean, I thought your discussion on that was the highlight of the game for me.
Yeah, it was a very, very interesting part of the game. And I kind of wish that that game specifically were longer than a one-shot because that's kind of a theme that I would have liked to explore a lot more. So yeah, I wish it had been more because it was really interesting, you know, to decide what is right, what is wrong, and it's a tough moral decision to see where it goes.
Not that it needed it, because as you said, Chris, and well, like most of the discussion was between, you know, Doctor Strange and Namor, but I like games where you have the mechanics to back stuff up if you need them, and yeah, I don't know, I'm kind of wondering. Well, I'd like to play Marvel Heroic again to see if there are kind of social mechanics in there and kind of how they would work. Because, like, we didn't actually need them because we just kind of, you know, role-played convincing each other and making good points. But, I don't know, I'm kind of wondering if they're there.
I think there's it's definitely not involved social mechanics like some other games, but there are some there. You remember we had one scene. This is actually maybe something to bring up because last time we reviewed Marvel, we only had combat, so right. This was more of a social situation. But I was talking to some guards and I was trying to find out some information of where they were supposed to be taking a prisoner. And in the Marvel game, there's several different categories, and in each different category, you choose some kind of skill or superpower or something that you used to add to a dice pool. And one of Namor's special powers, one of his special abilities was he was a psychological expert. So I built my dice pool using that and tried to convince the guards. Of course, I rolled horribly and it didn't work. But still, that's a type of social mechanic.
Yeah, I think when you have a dice pool game, yeah, I'm generalizing here, but I find that it gives you a certain amount of freedom.
Right.
That even if it's not explicitly a social game, it's very easy then to create the roles that you need in a social situation, just like Chris outlined. So I there are things in there, and I think what you do is then, instead of choosing the combat master when you get down to specialties, you might choose something like the business master or the psych master.
Yeah, and that goes on, like especially if you have a more versatile character like Doctor Strange that you played, Wayne, you know, his powers aren't all like flying and super strong and things like that. There were some different kinds of magic you could mix into that dice pool to do things like that as well.
That is true. And because of the way Marvel Heroic works, like you keep an effect die, and it's the size of the die or the number of sides that the die has that matters. So, like for example, Larry, you were running the game. So if Chris had succeeded at his attempt and had chosen like a big effect, like a D12, would you have given him more information as the guard than if he had to keep a D4 as his effect die?
Yeah, like there's a few things you can do with that. I mean, I could have given him more information. I could have made him like an actual ally. I mean, if you D12, which for the listeners is the max. And if people look at the Annihilation event that just come out and they see everybody's got like D12s, so it's amusing for us. And no one else. Sorry. Just chuck a little dice thing. It's like, oh, the D12s. Yeah.
Oh, those D12s. Yeah.
No. I just want to do, you know, just something about Marvel Heroic role-playing. It's one of those games where it's just like, hey, what would I do if you had a D4 versus a D12? Yeah, I could have given you more information. I could have made you an ally. And I think that's what I really like about this game is that it's easy to pick up the system. And then there's just a lot you can do with it. And you know, Wayne was playing Doctor Strange and you got magic. And in even the most mundane game, it's just like, what can you do with magic? And then in this game, it's like, wow, no, seriously, what can you do with magic?
Right.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to do with that. Yeah, and that effect die, it can be, it's something that kind of carries over. And I think that's something that, it can actually affect you directly, but if an effect die can actually be used in other respects in the game is kind of like an asset or a complication.
Right.
So if you imagine that it's something that can carry over into other actions, so.
Well, we did that right at the beginning because when, you know, you kind of set up the situation, it's like, okay, I think Iron Man and Mr. Fantastic had us go try and track down Captain America. And yeah, going into the magic thing, I'm like, well, all right, Doctor Strange has magic, so I should be able to cast a spell to just find where Captain America is, and yeah, then use that effect die as an asset of like marked or tracking beacon or something on Captain America, and it just kind of like hung around until we used it again. So
it was really good. It was nice to see the system to be able to support that, because you come up with a great idea and you're like, okay, I didn't expect you to do that, but the system actually then supported you being able to do that. So it's very easy to just incorporate that on the fly.
Hmm. Yeah, for me, I think this is probably my second favorite magic system that I've ever seen. And it's not a magic system, just the way that the power system works, because it allows you to be completely freeform with what you want to do. You say, I've got magic, I want to do this. And if it's, of course, you know, there are some limitations based on what your actual powers are, but it just allows you to do whatever you want with it, come up with anything. It's just fantastic. And that actually, that rule applies to all the superpowers as well. You know, if you're super strong, then it's not a matter of this is what plus you get added to your punch or here's your lifting score, but it's anything you can imagine to use with it, you're allowed to go and roll with it. It's fantastic.
Yeah, like I don't see any reason why you couldn't, with a character that has super strength, you know, make a roll and save that effect die and say, this now represents the asset of giant freaking crater in the street, you know?
Exactly, or car that I've picked up.
Yeah, exactly. But I guess this gets a little bit kind of back to what Chris said at the beginning about really having to know the system. Is, yeah, I chose Doctor Strange because I thought he looked pretty cool. And yeah, he has all those magical powers, but I knew nothing about what he did in the Marvel Universe. So when it was time for me to do something, and I looked at his sheet and I said, great, I have all these magical powers. I don't know what he can do with them in the fiction of the Marvel Universe. I can make stuff up, and like I didn't feel like I was cheating, but I kind of felt like I was playing the character wrong, or I was sometimes just at a loss because, yeah, I didn't really know, or I didn't have any examples of what he normally does with those powers. So, yeah, that tracking beacon was just, I have magic, so I should be able to do this, or, you know, turning the poison gas into what was it?
Vanilla.
Oh yeah, a cloud of vanilla. I'm like, I guess I can do that because I have magic. Is it something Doctor Strange would actually have done? I don't know.
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? So, yeah, the system is really flexible and it does have rules to back up pretty much anything you can come up with, and I really like that. But it's also kind of not intimidating, but it's almost one of those things where the freedom can be intimidating because
that's a very
there's
good point.
Just absolutely, you can literally do everything or anything you can think of.
You know, and this is something that Chris said right after we played was, you know, I really feel like if I had read the comic books, I could have like maybe done more, or I don't know if, or maybe you were uncertain of whether or not that was a limitation or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's exactly like you said, Wayne. You know, if you knew what Doctor Strange can do, then it would be a lot easier to play him. And it would be easier, maybe a more traditional system where you kind of have a list of magical spells that he can do, and these are his powers specifically. But I don't know, I think it's really a strength of the game that it can support you doing whatever you want to do. So even if you don't know how these characters behave or what their powers actually are, the details there on the page are open enough that you can just do what you feel you want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you had a good point when you said at the beginning of the game, you kind of need to decide, okay, are you going to play this Marvel character as they are in the Marvel Universe? Or are you going to play this character the way you think they can be played and kind of ignore canon? And yeah, as you said, you kind of can't do a mix. And this game, I kind of tried to play Doctor Strange as Doctor Strange and kind of failed. Whereas the first game, Lyle had lent me like a bunch of Fantastic Four comics, and reading those, I knew what the Invisible Woman could do. And so I kind of felt more confident using her powers, even though I stunk at it and didn't do anything with them. But I knew pretty much what she could do and what she could make with those, you know, force projection things. Whereas, yeah, with Doctor Strange, I'm like, I guess I could do this. I don't know.
Yeah, same deal. Like, as playing Namor, his powers were basically the same as Superman's, so I tried to play Superman.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
I guess it kind of gets into, like, I remember when the game first came out, I was kind of, not worried, but I was, I don't know, curious how they balanced the characters. And I think the answer is they didn't.
Yeah, they don't.
which at first I kind of thought was like a negative, but then I'm like, well, no, it kind of doesn't really matter because the system is so flexible. You can do so much with it where everybody is kind of on a level playing field. But now I'm seeing it as, okay, you're going to play this game. What Marvel character do you know the best? Mm-hmm. What Marvel character do you like the best? Which one's your favorite? Great. Now you're going to play that character because you know what they can do with those powers.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that's something that's kind of, I think, is important in a superhero kind of game, because a lot of superhero stories, a lot of the drama that comes out in superhero stories is people thinking of new and interesting ways to use their powers, because, I don't know, maybe they're facing a supervillain who can stand up to the normal way they use their powers. So it really lends into the genre very well. But, I don't know, there is a little bit of a downside to that. I think this might be misusing the word, but it's very realistic in that the characters on the sheet match with how they actually are in the universe. And there isn't that much balance in the Marvel universe. I mean, you take a look at, like, I don't know, what's her name? Jubilee from the X-Men, who can shoot sparks, versus, I don't know, like Namor, who is basically Superman. You know, there's quite a gulf there. So I suppose you might run into trouble if you have two characters that are extremely different power levels in the same group. But at the same time, though, the game is flexible enough to where you could still have a lot of fun with that regardless. Mm. Stuff.
No, it's interesting about balance. And one thing, when you get into the upper levels, you're looking at people like Hercules, Namor, let's say the Sentinel, and you're all looking at, like, their strength is D12.
Godlike?
Yeah, godlike. And they do something, people who remember the old Marvel game that was, I think, made by TSR, and they had things like Feeble, Excellent, Amazing, and then they had numbers that correspond, and Marvel Heroic Roleplaying actually does something similar, and they'll have, like, godlike, and godlike corresponds to D12. But when you think, it's like, once you cap out at D12, and this also gets into Annihilation, it's like, everybody's got a lot of D12s, you know, how do you make these characters different from each other? So Hercules took on Code Lightning, or the, people who are familiar with Civil War, the kind of the clone of Thor, and they both had D12 strength. So how do you work that out? But it was the special effects. And then there was also the Hulk robot.
Yeah.
Who also has D12 godlike strength. And it actually, the special effects actually provided enough variety that it did feel like you're playing different characters. Even though they were primarily relying on their strength in those scenarios.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know what special effects Code Lightning had, but since Hercules was on our side, yeah, he kind of had that grapple thing, and the, what was the name of that special effect where he could...
Boundless Strength?
Yeah.
He did have grappling.
Yeah, yeah. So it was like two separate things. He had both grappling and Boundless Strength. And yeah, both of those played off his strength, obviously. But yeah, you're absolutely right, Lyle. The special effects made him feel really different than what, you know, the clone Thor was doing. So I really like how they do that. I guess the only downside, and it might be like a minor one, is, yeah, kind of skimming through Annihilation, some characters have like a list of special effects a mile long. And looking at that, I think that's a lot to remember. And I would not feel confident playing those characters, especially as a watcher, you know, having to remember all these lists of special effects for my bad guys.
But I think that, you know, it gets into one of the questions that we had, that when we were thinking about which game to play, but also what we said at the beginning of the episode, is Civil War a more advanced game than Marvel Heroic Roleplaying? Yes. Is Annihilation a more advanced game than Civil War? I think so.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like, well, I suppose like D&D, where, you know, it's like the higher the level, the more you have to remember.
Right.
So the more difficult the game. So Marvel Heroic Roleplaying is the same, even though they don't have a level system like we would think. When you're getting into kind of, you're going from like small scale to, you know, across all of North America to cosmic scale, then yeah, the game actually scales up with that as well.
Yeah.
And that was it was really good to learn, so that we could pass it on to people. It's just like, probably I would not go with Annihilation as your starter game. As much as you love cosmic characters and Thanos and other characters like that. You know, I'm a big Jim Starlin fan, and he's written some great cosmic stories. But, you know, if I was going to play this game, I would start at the basic, at least. And if you want to jump then to Annihilation, that's great. You don't necessarily need to do the Civil War, you know, step in between. Mm. But you just really got to get down. It's like, what can I do with these special effects to play the game?
Or even before that, what can I do just with this normal die, this normal power, and the effect die? Because you can do a lot just with that and no special effects.
Yeah, even just making your dice pool, and the game walks you through it really well, and it's just like, it's just one thing about Marvel Heroic Roleplaying, is you play the game, and you're like, wow, I did all this, and damn, I could have done so much more. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those games where you kind of, you feel like, well, you know, with the sky was the limit, and I don't think I did the sky. Mm-hmm. I just kind of like hit the clouds, want to do more.
I think that's why we played it again.
Yeah, no, it's one of those games. It's like really, really addictive. Like, right away, like you're like, wow, I love this game. Damn, I wish I knew the rules a bit better, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's not as rigid as like a lot of games where it was just like, well, I'm going to do this. And you're like, well, you can't do that because you have to do this. I'm like, all right, I'll do that then. Thanks.
Yeah, I
hope I remember that next time. But this one, it was like, okay, I'll do this. Sure. How do you do that? I'll do it this way. Okay. And you're like, then later on, you're like, damn, I could have done it another way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that I know you don't really buy into the term narrative game much, Lyle, but I think it is a really nice medium between kind of a stricter rule-based game and something more on a narrative-type level. You know, you're allowed to have a lot of freedom with the story and the characters and stuff, but there is still a good, solid supportive rules behind it.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. Like, as we keep saying, like, the rules are really flexible, so instead of having to, like, interpret rules and kind of fudge rules and say, okay, well, this rule is going to cover this situation because it's kind of similar. You're just like, nope, there's the rule, and you can do but just about anything with the way this dice pool is built. So whatever you're going to do, kind of the system can handle it. There you go.
Yeah, I think when I say I don't buy into narrative games, it's just because I know that there's games like Marvel Heroic Roleplaying that don't necessarily present themselves as a narrative game. They just kind of present themselves as a game, you know, and you kind of see that even though there's a lot of dice used in the game, that it is so flexible and so broad.
Yeah.
So.
But also pretty basically easy.
Yeah.
Easy to learn, but difficult to master, as one of you guys said earlier.
Yeah, that was wild. Yeah.
Well, that ends this week's episode, which was a hybrid episode between some great questions from Ross from Role Playing Public Radio and our review of Civil War. I think it's come clear that we're pretty big fans of Marvel Heroic Roleplaying. And it's just one of those games that if there's any frustration, the frustration is that you can do a lot more with the game. So it kind of encourages you to just keep playing to get used to it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, we do actually have a little snippet of the final combat of our session, and we'll be uploading that later after this episode. So if you are interested in hearing how a combat went with us, then check again in a couple days, and you'll be able to hear just kind of an actual roleplay-only episode.
Yep. All right, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through Stitcher or iTunes, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can post up on the website there, because we have turned the comments back on. Yay! Ooh. Or you can send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or on Twitter. And yeah, please do send us something, because we're always interested in hearing from you. And thanks again, Ross, for sending us an email.
Bye.
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 Drive-Thru RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-Thru RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.